This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello, yes, welcome to Conversation Hour. I'm Mary Guerin. Well, yes, it's already been a big news day. Are we on a slippery slope to war, that is? Are we involved or not? Is it semantics anyway? This hour we're going to get differing opinions, differing reactions to the developments that happened by the time you and I woke up, the developments that see ourselves involve ourselves more in the Iranian conflict. But what do you think? Are we already on a slippery slope? Or is this the least we could do? Just to catch people up, if you haven't heard, we are sending some of our people, some of our missiles, and a military surveillance plane to the Middle East, to the UAE. And the government insists it's a purely defensive move. The defence minister and the prime minister repeated that many times this morning. What do you think about that term? Does it ring true with you? As I said, during this hour, we're going to get some differing analyses of whether that's possible to ring fence it off as a defensive move or not, whether or not that even matters. We've seen the Shadow Energy Minister Dan Tehan this morning saying that Australia is now an active participant in the war in the Middle East. So what do you think about that? Do you believe these characterisations? Does it even matter? Is it just semantics? And should we have had a vote about it, even for this level of lending military support to a country that is involved in a war? I'm going to be speaking within this hour to a former senator who's in a group that's been campaigning for there to be mandatory parliamentary discussions about even this level of involvement. I'd love to hear your point of view on that. Also, do you believe the US President Donald Trump when he says the war is, well, this is an actual quote from what he told one reporter overnight, the war is very complete, pretty much. Do you believe that? The Australian Stock Exchange, we were told, is expected to bet on that. What are your feelings about it? Also, I talked about a couple of developments overnight. One very notable one is that we have granted asylum to five Iranian female soccer players who've escaped their minders. And Tony Burke says, we've taken these women into our hearts. And if anyone else on the team want to seek that asylum, we will give it to them. How do you feel about that? We're going to be speaking a little later to Craig Foster, who, of course, is the former Socceroo, who's championed the cause for the Iranian soccer players, and we'll get his reaction to it. As I say, we'll be speaking to a range of experts about the situation we find ourselves in. Also, it's not all war in this conversation hour. It's somewhat tangentially connected. We do have a former reality TV star running this Middle East war, it seems, and I'm asking you, does it change how you feel about an actor if you know that they started on reality TV? Is there such a thing as a reality TV stigma in someone's past? I'm asking because apparently three Oscar nominations, and the Oscars are just next week, just around the corner. They're going to people who got their start in reality TV. What do you think about that? Has it lost any stigma in your mind? We will get to that a little bit later. But next, let's talk to an international law expert about developments overnight.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Donald Rothwell, of course, international law expert, about what we've seen overnight. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Mary.
What do you think about this situation that we are in? Are we at war? Are we in a conflict or aren't we?
Oh, we've definitely now committed to the conflict, and I took particular significance from the fact that the Prime Minister in his statement that you've referred to used the terminology collective self-defence, that Australia was responding to a request from the Gulf states, in particular the UAE, and that Australia was supporting those states as part of collective self-defence. That's terminology that international lawyers immediately understand. It's actually a phrase that's found in the United Nations Charter, And as soon as you engage in collective self-defence, you are a part of the international armed conflict that exists in the region at the moment.
So much of this seems to be about semantics, Donald Rothwell. If that is the term they come up with it now, even though we're assisting a country in its self-defence, that we are part of an international armed conflict, are we going to see the same sort of wordplay here that was also happening in Washington for a time where we insist this isn't war?
I don't really think that the Albanese government can take that line of course, partly because the conflict is much more advanced now. And we know, of course, that one of the reasons why Australia's made this commitment is that whilst originally this might have been seen as a conflict only involving three states, Israel, the United States and Iran, that we know that it's spread throughout the region, and ultimately Australia's getting involved in that. So I don't think that those distinctions are relevant. But what is significant, of course, which is what you're alluding to, is the ever-widening scope of this conflict. And let's face it, last week we saw the United States use a submarine to target an Iranian naval vessel in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Sri Lanka. That was well outside of most people's expectations, as indeed probably was the expectation that Australia would be joining a Gulf state 11 days into this conflict to provide them with collective self-defence.
Mm. You're listening to Donald Rothwell, ANU international law expert. Also part of what both the Defence Minister and the Prime Minister repeated this morning is that the military support we are giving is just defensive. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, I think I place some significance on the way in which that terminology has been used. And obviously the distinction is offensive as opposed to defensive. And we had an introduction to that terminology last week when the Prime Minister made clear that the three Australian submariners on the US submarine in the Indian Ocean were not engaged in offensive actions. So obviously phrasing as in the context of defensive conduct is entirely consistent with what I said before about collective self-defence, that Australia is not seeking to engage itself in this conflict in terms of mounting an attack against Iran, but rather that it's seeking to defend the Gulf states, and in this case particularly the United Arab Emirates, from any attacks that they might face. And the only state that's attacking the Gulf states at the moment is in fact the Iranians, which is arising from their own retaliation to the attacks that they're facing from the US and Israel. So the characterisation, I think, politically is very important for the Australian population, but legally it makes no difference at all, other than the fact that there's no real legal question in my mind about the legitimacy of the way in which Australia is seeking to engage in this conduct as joining another partner state in collective self-defence.
Interesting you should bring that up, Donald Rothwell. A little later in the hour, we will be talking to a group that's been well recognised for its efforts over years to make sure that we get parliamentary votes, even for this level of conflict. At the moment, as it stands, everything you're saying is legal, obviously, what the Australian government is doing. But should it be?
Look,
without a vote, is what I'm saying.
You're right that this has been the subject of ongoing debate, and perhaps this reached great intensity when Australia committed itself to the Iraq conflict back in 2003, which, it needs to be acknowledged, had been subject to significant parliamentary debate, but no actual parliamentary vote. So, yes, there is this ongoing debate in Australia as to whether or not Parliament should play an active role in these matters. Fortunately, Parliament is actually sitting at the moment. So no doubt question time today in Parliament will be dominated by these particular issues, but there will probably be no formal vote because, as you're alluding to, there's actually no formal requirement for the Parliament to vote on these matters. And it's interesting to contrast the Australian position with the fact that even in the United States last week, we saw votes before the US House of Representatives and the US Senate on certain issues as to whether or not President Trump's actions were consistent with the US Constitution. So this is a very live and active debate in Australia. And no doubt these events will just further generate discussion on these questions.
And before I let you go, Donald Rothwell, I just wanted to play you a grab from mornings when RAF Epstein was talking to Lieutenant General Peter Lay, the former Chief of the Army. This goes to what you were talking about. It's a fast-moving situation. We've got these incremental steps overnight. But has even this issue of whether these actions from the US and Israel, whether they are legal under international law, are we moving so quickly away from even examining that? This is what Peter Lay said when RAF asked whether he's concerned about the legality of the war.
Let me ask this, is it a question that concerns you?
Certainly it's a question that concerns me, but I think my concern is more that Iran could continue to do what they've been doing, and we therefore might like to question the nature of the international law.
We might like to question the nature of the international law, was that comment. Donald Rothwell, what's your reaction to that? Are things moving so quickly that we're running well beyond that question?
I think that's a fair analysis, and whilst I and virtually every other credible international lawyer that I know have roundly condemned the legal basis or the legal justification that Israel and the United States sought to mount for the 28 February attacks on Iran, we have now moved well beyond that. And in any event, whilst Iran, under international law, has an ability to exercise self-defense, that's not contested. It cannot, in exercising that self-defense, seek to imperil the safety and security of the Gulf states. And accordingly, what Australia is saying is that, well, the Gulf states are now being imperiled by what at face value appears to be Iran's retaliatory attacks, which is going well beyond just attacking Israeli and American assets in the region, but is spreading far and wide throughout the Gulf. Australia is then coming to the aid of those Gulf states. But it just does very much highlight the core aspect of your question about the escalatory nature of a conflict such as this.
Things are on a slippery slope, potentially. Thank you so much for joining us, Donald Rothwell.
Good to speak to you, Mary. Bye now.
That's Donald Rothwell, an expert in international law at the ANU. We are going to be hearing a slightly different analysis a little later in this hour, about how far we are officially, if you like, within this conflict. But let's go now to the other development overnight. That is, of course, the five Iranian soccer players who've been granted asylum and an offer from the Australian government to do the same for others. Craig Foster joins us now, who, of course, has championed the cause for these players and others as well. Thanks for joining me, Craig.
That's okay. Nice to speak with you.
Great to speak with you. What's your reaction?
Well, it's mixed because the fact that five have now sought and been granted asylum only demonstrates the risk that they and then likely others face. And so it's still very much a live, evolving situation. And so there's still a large group, most of them under control of the same management, of the Iranian Football Federation. And so now we kind of move to the stage where there's an extreme and, I think, escalating risk of them possibly being forcibly removed from Australia, the remaining group. I think it's pretty clear that that would be, is likely the wish of, the Iranian government and Football Federation. And so that means that I think there's a duty of care to Australian authorities to make sure that the remaining women aren't being forcibly removed. People might have seen the New South Wales anti-slavery commissioner came out and talked about forced trafficking, which essentially it would be illegal under Australian law. And therefore, I think that means that Australian authorities can and should intervene. What that intervention looks like, is a different question. However, I don't think we should allow this team to be removed from the country without being satisfied that all of them have had the opportunity to both understand their rights and possibly to exercise them.
It's coming up to 20 past 11. You're listening to Craig Foster about the asylum seeking women of the Iranian soccer team and those who remain. Craig, it's clear that we don't know a lot about what's been going on behind the scenes. It was clear from the Prime Minister's comments that even the media have been keeping Sturm on some developments that they have heard about behind the scenes, to the gratitude of the government. Is there anything that you know I'm not asking you to spell it out, but that you know that would encourage you to think that the remaining members of the squad would have the opportunity to reach out if they can?
I think the Prime Minister is right in that. There's been a lot of restraint shown by the local organising committee, by the local football federation, and by a lot of the stakeholders involved. And that's been good because these are very sensitive and very dangerous situations. The wrong public actions can actually increase the danger to these types of groups. So what I would say is that the risk is very high to extreme to the remaining group, and that Australian government is right in saying that we're very concerned that they may be trafficked or may be forcibly removed from the country. That's really the key issue at the moment. And so we need to think through, or the Australian government authorities, Australian Federal Police, for example, need to think through what type of additional interventions would be needed in relation to the remaining members of the group, whether they understand their rights or have the opportunity to speak to independent parties. And by the way, that's also important with the five. They need independent legal advice that is independent of Home Affairs and the government as well. That needs to occur between now and at any point at which they may be trying to leave the country. That's what we need to be satisfied of, that all of the players have an opportunity in a safe, confidential environment to be asked the relevant questions, advised of their rights, and be able to express those rights if they so wish.
Craig Foster, you also played a key part in helping the Afghanistan women's team flee the Taliban in 2021, so you have a history in this. I just want to play you a little bit of Tony Burke, the Home Affairs Minister, this morning in his press conference that goes to, I guess, the connection that the Australian public have felt with this team.
I say to the other members of the team, the same opportunity is there. Australia has taken the Iranian women's soccer team into our hearts.
What do you think of that statement? And I guess also knowing that you're probably still in touch with that Afghanistan women's team. How do you feel that Australians have wrapped themselves around this team and others?
You know, it's really wonderful when Australians see that people are in danger situations, and we come to understand what they're facing, particularly women. Australia's response to women at risk is always really profoundly based on care and compassion. That's wonderful. We should remember that these five who've sought asylum are now asylum seekers, refugees, and we've also had concerns in this country with those. So these moments can be important ones to make those connections and draw the lines between some people that are perhaps looked at in a negative light and people who play sport like these women. We look at them in a different light, as we did Hakim Al-Arabi and others. But those are conversations for down the line. I think it's great that Australia has responded positively to this group who very clearly were at risk. It is very I think Australia should be delighted and, in fact, proud, really, that the Australian government has deemed it necessary to step in and actually intervene and ensure that they have access to understand their rights and exercise them. This doesn't happen in a lot of countries around the world. We see countries, even ones that we thought better of, doing exactly the opposite. So we have a lot to be, really proud of. But at the same time, let's make sure that, politics doesn't override the considerations about these women. Of course, there's a whole massive geopolitical fabric or matrix over the top of this team, and they've been used as political pawns by the Iranians, that's for sure. You've seen Trump try to get involved now. This is what happens in these environments when people are at risk in high-profile situations. It's absolutely critical that everyone is concerned about one thing only, and that is not politics, but it's about the welfare of all of these women. So, yes, it's wonderful that five have been granted protection. Let's now turn our attention to the others, and let's make sure that the only consideration is the well-being and safety of these women.
Craig Foster, thank you for joining us.
Okay, pleasure.
That's Craig Foster, of course, former captain of the Australian men's football team and a prominent human rights advocate when it comes to these matters as well. Steve, in Point Albert, what do you think?
I think we focus too much on sports people. There's lots of people in the world that need to be repatriated, but we always concentrate on sport. We have a love affair with sport.
Steve, I take your point that there are a lot of other people in need, but with this particular team at this particular time and moment and place, was there still a reason for Australia to at least make consideration of that?
I think in the past they've rejected and made it very hard for people to repatriate, and they've sort of opened the door with open arms because they're sports people.
Steve, thank you. Do you agree with Steve? 1300 222 774. I'd love to know. This from Pete. Good morning, Mary. I think Australia must remain as neutral as possible. This is not weakness. We are a nation of people from all over the globe. This, of course, goes to the military support that's been announced that we're giving to the UAE. We can't take a side, says Pete, without offending or alienating a section of our population. We need to be good humanitarians, and we need to stay out of international conflicts to protect our own cohesion and prosperity. Andy says, if you enter a theatre of war as a participant, you may not have the luxury of taking a defensive posture only. Andy, of course, is referring to the Prime Minister and Defence Minister's repetition that the missiles that they're sending, the military surveillance, the personnel that they're sending, are part of a defensive move only. Andy says, you open yourself up to attack and will be under pressure to respond if attacked. So, yes, we are at war, and Parliament should have been consulted. Shortly, we will be speaking with someone who's in a campaign group called Australians for War Powers Reform about whether or not we should have had a vote, should be having a vote about even this level of support, even if it is defensive.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And it is coming up to 28 minutes past 11. Australians for War Powers Reform is the name of the campaign group, and the president is Andrew Bartlett, who was a senator for Queensland, a parliamentary leader of the Australian Democrats, was a Green senator as well. He joins me now. Hello.
Yeah, good day.
Thank you for joining us. Tell me what your reaction is as the president of the Australian for War Powers Reform to what you've heard about Australia's commitment to the UAE.
Oh, look, I think there's, you know, our core business is about transparency and actually having a parliamentary debate and parliamentary decision when we go to war and get involved in wars. And, you know, the nature of war has changed over the decades. But as you were just saying, you know, you can get involved and think you're being defensive. It's very easy to get involved in a war. It's often very hard to get out of a war. And the very least we should expect is for you know, some proper transparency and proper parliamentary debate and decisions about these things before we get ourselves involved in them, which is, you know, seems to be what's happening right now without, you know, without really much discussion at all, really. And, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people are pretty cynical about how truthful politicians are, particularly when they're looking at the US politicians that started this whole thing. You know, that's why we need some proper transparency and some proper focus on what we're actually doing.
Mm. If we're worried about slippery slope issues, Andrew Bartlett, at what point do we need a parliamentary vote in your view? What's the threshold then? Is it sending anything, bullets? Is it about personnel? At what point do we need that vote?
Well, I think that one of the challenges here is it's changed so much. You know, way back, you know, 70-odd years ago, our Prime Minister would stand up in Parliament and say, you know, it's my reluctant duty to say we're at war with whoever. That doesn't happen now. We just sort of get oozed into it a lot of the time. You know, because we have these alliances, these interoperability with various allies, and we just sort of get pulled in. You know, I think the key thing is that it needs to be much more transparent. I mean, you've had so much denial over the last couple of years about Australia's weapons trade with Israel and what's happening there, and, you know, people have their different views about that, but we're just not being told the truth about this, and that, you know, apart from anything else, makes people more and more cynical and disconnected from how our politics works, and that's, you know, that has a wider problem than just the fact that we're getting pulled into another war, which does seem to be happening here. So it, you know, it's a bit of both things. It's about the specifics of what's happening and whether or not that's a good thing. You know, we're just being told this is happening. There's just nothing anyone can do about it. We're just being told. And then there's the second part of it, of people just getting more and more dubious about how accurate the facts are that we're being told. For what are, you know, these are significant things. It's not, you know, it's not a cartoon. It's not a movie. It's, you know, people die. People are dying, and, you know, it's having major economic effects on Australia already, and probably diplomatic and all sorts of other things. And we're meant to just, you know, sit back and be passive consumers of it all. I just don't think that's the right way to do it.
Mm. Andrew Bartley, we also heard Donald Rothwell from the ANU, of course, international law expert, who said that he feared that, in fact, all questions of legality even about this war have been swept away due, essentially, to the fast-moving situation. Can you explain exactly what your group is campaigning for that would preempt any involvement at all? Are you calling for a whole of parliament vote at any stage of any conflict?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what we've been about, and we formed back with the Iraq War, which, you know, most people would remember from 2003, the second Iraq War, where, you know, in fact, there was a parliamentary vote and the Senate voted against it, but the government went ahead anyway. We don't think a decision as huge as that should be just up to, you know, one guy, basically, or a few people, and particularly without any transparency, without any debate, without any discussion. So, you know, that's our core business. Mm. You know, I think most wars tend to be bad. However good an idea they seem at the time, they tend to turn out to be bad. But,
well, it's interesting you should say that. I'm just seeing a text come through saying, you're asking us to leave a murderous president and a 34-time convicted criminal anti-Donald Trump, obviously, there. But there'd be many people on text as well who I can see are saying, look, we've got to do something. What you're saying is, doesn't matter if a war is good or bad, it needs to be voted on.
Yeah, well, because you've got to actually need some transparency about this, because, you know, almost always, not every single time, but almost always, you know, we get lied to get led into a war or to support a war in all sorts of different ways. And, you know, maybe we're not front and centre of it, we're enabling it. And, you know, our government has come out and said they support this, even though it's, you know, very obviously against international law. And fine, people can say, well, who cares about international law? But then, well, what does that mean? You know, let's have that discussion. Is international law meaningless now? Is the rules-based national order meaningless now? Maybe it is. Let's have that discussion. Let's not pretend it means something one week and not something the other week.
I must ask you, as a former senator and watching this with that lens of being anti-war, what is your prediction about where this much vaunted international rules-based world has gone? Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, says it's gone already. What do you think?
Oh, look, you know, I agree with what he said, although I will note Mark Carney also supports this war, but, you know, he's entitled to have his opinion.
He's in a tricky position.
Yeah, but, yeah, no, I mean, it was always a farce. It was always a farce. And, that, you know, without, you know, Australia's War Powers Reform Act are about transparency and debate. You know, I think every sane person should be anti-war. Doesn't mean that occasionally wars need to happen, but, you know, you really want to do everything you can to have them not happen, because there are a few things worse than having a war for all sorts of reasons. But yeah, you know, that international rules-based order, you know, and Mark Carney, I think, billed the cat there very well, took down the sign, all that sort of stuff that he said. But
yeah.
It would... it was always a farce, and it was obviously a farce, and we were all meant to go along with it. And, you know, I guess that's part of why, you know, from, you know, my organisation's point of view, is like, this, you know, if you actually have a debate about these things, have a proper open discussion, you can see that it's a farce. And, you know, what do you do next is an open question. But we're still kidding ourselves, and we're kidding ourselves now, I think, about this current conflict, about what's going on, and that's what really makes me uneasy, regardless of people's views about it. Is, you know, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, when you're doing stuff and kidding yourself about what you're doing, that's not a good thing.
Before I let you go, Andrew Bartlett, I'll put this text from Claire to you. It would worry me if it went to the whole Parliament. I think many of them are ill-informed about the situations, and I think that's what we put our faith in. Is there a government who can make those decisions? And I'm happy with, obviously, if it was full-blown when we were sending troops, then I would expect them to obviously talk to the opposition. There is a cynicism about even the people who are making those decisions, even if it is a whole of Parliament exercise. Isn't that true, Andrew Bartlett?
Yeah, well, you know, you're going to have cynicism about the people in the government, you're going to have cynicism about the Parliament, and I'm certainly not going to, again, not going to fib that, you know, in my experience, that everyone in Parliament is, you know, a wonderful person with, you know, great insight, etc. But the point isn't who are the good people and bad people. It's not a black hat and white hat. It's transparency. And the problem is we just get told this stuff's happening. And if you have a vote in Parliament, means you've got to have a debate in Parliament, means you've got to actually put forward some justifications in Parliament. And, you know, without trying to sound too noble, there's still a little bit of a thing of, like, you shouldn't lie to the Parliament.
Seems like the minimum bar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people do, etc. I'm not trying to be too starry-eyed myself, but, you know, there's a bit of an extra bar there if you're like, you've actually got to say to the Parliament stuff, and if you're making stuff up and saying it to the Parliament, that's not so good. So
making it's people accountable. Andrew Bartlett, thank you for your time.
No worries.
That's Andrew Bartlett, president of the campaign group Australians for War Powers Reform. Do you agree with him? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Mary, you've called from Ballarat. What do you think?
Oh, morning. I think we've lost our sovereignty. We lost it with AUKUS, and until we have a government with sufficient courage to get us out of it, we are tied to any war America chooses to engage in. And I think a lot of the thoughtful conversation this morning, it's a nice community safety valve release, but it's all out of our control.
You think we're on a slippery slope, Mary?
I think we're fully committed to the degree to which the US and Israel choose, or the US.
Mary?
I'd actually like to have a government also with the courage to have an adult conversation about the implications of AUKUS with the Australian people.
Yes, they are adjacent but very connected issues. Mary, thank you for calling. We are going to be speaking very soon to another analyst about whether or not we are really at war or not. Where are we this morning?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
I'm joined now by Dr. Malcolm Davis, who's a senior analyst in the Defence Strategy Program in ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. It's an independent, non-partisan think tank, and I want to hear his thoughts on whether we are at war or not. Thank you for joining us, Malcolm Davis.
It's my pleasure.
We've heard a lot of talk this morning, and you just heard Mary from Ballarat saying she doesn't believe, you know, that we are just a little bit in it. We're in it all the way. What's your take on the extent of our involvement as it stands after this morning's developments?
We're definitely not in it all the way. I think that essentially what we are seeing is the Australian government responding to a legitimate request for assistance from the Gulf states. I believe it's the UAE is the state that has made this request. They are under constant daily attack by the Iranians, with missiles and drones coming in, hitting not only military facilities, but also oil infrastructure and civilian targets as well, including airports, where a number of people have been killed and wounded as a result of these Iranian attacks. So the Gulf Cooperation Council states have made a legitimate request for assistance to defend their airspace against these attacks. Australia has responded, I think, in an effective manner with the deployment of an E-7 Wedgetail airborne early warning and control aircraft, as well as the supply of advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles to the UAE Air Force. So this is a defensive deployment. This is not an offensive deployment. You are not seeing Royal Australian Air Force fighter jets doing strikes on Iran. You're not seeing Australian Army personnel going in boots on the ground. You're not seeing Royal Australian Naval warships going into combat against Iran. These are defensive deployments only.
How does Australia maintain that it's defensive if, for instance, we're giving over these missiles? Can we guarantee that they won't be used in an offensive manner?
Yeah, in the sense that, let's look at the tactical situation. The Iranian Air Force has been blown out of the sky. So the Iranian Air Force is no longer flying. The threat we are facing from the Iranians is these drones and missiles that the Iranians are firing. And where these AMRAAM missiles that we've supplied to the UAE are going to come in handy is increasing the ability of the UAE Air Force to be able to shoot down those incoming drones and missiles, particularly the drones that are causing death and destruction across the Gulf states. So what you're going to see is those missiles being put into effect in a defensive manner to shoot down incoming threats.
We've heard this morning from Don Rothwell from ANU, international law expert, who says that in the statement this morning, this phrase that we are engaging in collective self-defense efforts means that we're part of an international armed conflict. We've got the opposition saying Australia is now an active participant in the war in the Middle East. Notwithstanding everything that you're saying, that it is limited and it is defensive, would you agree also that we are effectively part of a war now?
Well, we are supporting defensive operations. We're supporting missile defense. We're supporting counter-drone operations for the Gulf states. And I emphasize my point that I made earlier. Civilians are being targeted by the Iranians in these attacks. So therefore, what we're doing actually is trying to save lives. We are going in there with the Wedgetail to provide enhanced intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities, so we understand the battle space a bit more effectively. We can see where the threats are coming. That gives the defensive teams on the ground with the missile defense capabilities a greater chance of shooting down those incoming missiles and drones. So what we're doing is a defensive role to save lives on the ground, including, I would add, potentially the lives of Australian citizens that are still in the war zone, that are still trapped in places like Dubai and Doha. So I don't think we can say that this is necessarily a bad thing.
It is 17 minutes to 12, and you are listening to Dr. Malcolm Davis, a senior analyst in the Defence Strategy Program in the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. You were mentioning there that there is no air force left, that they have been blown out of the sky, in your opinion. I just wanted to go to some audio we have here of some comments, some recent comments from President Donald Trump.
We're achieving major strides toward completing our military objective. And some people could say they're pretty well complete. We've wiped every single force in Iran out. Very completely,
he says. And another quote was, they've wiped out Iran's Navy, Air Force and much of its missile capability, and they did it in just one week of war. What's your assessment of this this line from Donald Trump, who says the war is very complete, pretty much?
It's certainly not over. I disagree with President Trump there. I think the challenge we have is not their traditional forces, you know, the Air Force and the Navy. And, you know, he's correct there. We've largely destroyed the Iranian Air Force, and we've certainly sunk most of their Navy. I think the challenge we have now are these ballistic missiles, the cruise missiles and the drones. Certainly we have what's known as air superiority over Iran, which allows our the US Air Force and the Israeli Air Force to operate over Iran to attack ballistic missiles and drones and launching sites when they're detected. But we simply don't know how many more of these missiles and drones the Iranians have hidden away. So I think it's very risky at this point in time to, shall we say, declare victory. to declare mission accomplished, because ultimately there's this old saying, the enemy always gets a vote. And all the indications are that the Iranians will keep on fighting. So
how do you marry then?
I don't see this war ending in the next few days.
How do you marry then what you've said so far in terms of it's not going to be over in the next few days, but we will only have a very limited role? Is there not that sense that we could be dragged down a slippery slope?
Well, no, it's down to the government. I mean, the role that we have with these deployments is defensive. It's shooting down incoming threats in the form of Iranian missiles and drones. And the deployment of the Wedgetail and the supply of the MRAMs to the UAE Air Force is designed to do precisely that. There's no suggestion whatsoever that this government will suddenly say, oh, we're going to deploy ground forces to launch attacks on Iran, or we'll deploy fighter jets to launch strikes into Iran. There's no suggestion whatsoever that that's going to happen. And the very fact that the foreign minister said this is a four-week deployment reinforces the fact that this government is making it very clear that we will not be dragged down some slippery slope into a wider war.
Malcolm Davis, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Malcolm Davis from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And we're getting many of your texts in, taking issue with what Dr. Davis has said, and also talking about welcoming those asylum-seeking soccer players who've been granted asylum overnight. Two big developments overnight that we've been talking about during Conversation Hour. But now, it's time for a little change of pace. It's not all war here on the Conversation Hour. We have been talking about a war, well, led by a former reality TV star. Reality TV's come a long way, hasn't it? You have got actors now who are nominated for Oscars who started in reality TV. If you've been a snob about reality TV, does it change how you feel about an actor if you know that that's where they started? Have they now reached a level of credibility? We're going to be talking about the importance and the dark arts of casting and how casting agents regard people who come from a reality TV background.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 12 minutes to 12. The Academy Awards are just around the corner. After nearly a century, there is a brand new Oscar, an Oscar for Best Casting, recognising the people who decide who we're actually watching up there on the screen. And it comes at an interesting moment in the industry because the paths into acting seem to be changing. And this year there are a few Oscar-nominated actors who started out on reality TV. Maybe you thought that would be pretty unlikely at some point. I'd love to hear from you. 1300 222 774, what you think about reality TV on a CV. And I recently saw Marty Supremo, like a lot of people. Casting there was high on the agenda. There were celebrity cameos, public personas. Everyone seems to get a shot at the screen. To tell us about the dark art of casting, I'm joined by Annie Murta Monks, who is casting director and acting coach, also a committee member of the Casting Guild of Australia. Thanks for joining me, Annie.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much, Mary. It seems a bit odd after the serious things that have been happening today.
Well, and, we need a change of pace, don't we?
Talking about something lighter, yes.
Well, I'll just get your reaction first off to this new Oscar.
Ah, well, I think it's fantastic. Finally, our Casting Guild in Australia, the CGA, Casting Guild of Australia, we were pushing for many years to try and establish an award in our Australian equivalent to the Oscars, and we did finally get that a few years ago. And finally, now America also recognises casting directors' contributions to productions. So it's great. I wouldn't call it a dark arts. I might question that. Well, and, Yeah.
Before we get to the reality TV aspect, which I just find fascinating, tell me about, I call it dark arts because I honestly mean that as a compliment. I feel like I walk out of some movies or away from TV shows and I just think that there was someone who was there who saw potential with that particular face and voice for this particular character because it connected so much better than if someone else had played it. How do you actually make those decisions?
Look, one thing I would say is that no casting director makes the final decision. It's always these days by committee. So certainly our job as casting directors, and in Australia we don't call ourselves casting agents because an agent takes a commission from what someone earns. In Australia that doesn't happen. We are hired by production companies, producers or directors or production companies to find the best possible actors. But what we do, our job is really to be aware of who is around and try to bring their notice to the directors and producers and all of the people involved in that production who give the final okay. How do you do it? I suppose it takes quite a few years. I mean, I originally trained as an actor at NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art, and worked as an actor and an acting coach for several years and then was asked to cast something and then I moved into casting. So
you've had that real insight as to what works.
Yes, I think hopefully, and it also hopefully enables me and many of my colleagues to be able to assist actors to give their best possible auditions for things when they are in the room and auditioning, to help relax them and be able to show their best work, I would hope. But also it's trying to understand what the vision is of a project and what the unique challenge is involved in an acting sense and a creative sense.
It's 8 minutes to 12. You're listening to Annie Murta-Monks, casting director and acting coach. And I'm asking people, does it make a difference if an actor comes from a reality TV background? Because the Oscars have a few nominations there with involving actors with reality TV backgrounds. Annie, how much have times changed, I guess? Reality TV used to potentially be a blight on someone's CV?
Look, I suppose since reality TV reared its head, if people have a burning desire to be actors and to express themselves in that way, they're going to try and find all possible ways. So there are particular actors like, say, Jessie Buckley, who she had applied to acting school a couple of times in the UK and been turned down, and I think was quite frustrated and disillusioned. She'd come from a small village in Ireland. She ended up going on a reality show in 2008, one called I'll Do Anything, which sounds very exploitative, where they got actors to do weird things as well as sing every week. And she ended up being a popular favourite on that show, where the audience were voting for who should stay in. She didn't end up winning it, but then she went on and she studied and she did a 3 or 4 year degree at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, and graduated in 2013. So although she got her initial recognition, if you like, or notice then, she did go on and do training. And the similar with Emma Stone, who was in a pretty crappy.
I've seen some clips of her on reality TV and it looks terrible. I encourage people, definitely including the fans, to look it up because it's fantastic.
It is. She really had a lot of chutzpah. But she had been doing acting classes since she was a child and her parents had been very supportive. And then she'd gone and she was in that In Search of the Partridge Family show in 2004. But then she's gone on and done other training. So what I would say is, when actors or people have a burning desire to act and express themselves in that way, they will find a way to do it. You don't have to go through a 3-year acting degree at WAPA or NIDA or VCA. There are other ways, and many of our most successful Australian actors didn't do that.
Yes, good luck to all of them. Annie Murta-Monks, thank you so much for joining us.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
The Victorian government has just announced that from today, fuel retailers must cap their fuel costs for 24 hours and publish the price a day in advance. To tell us how it all works, Rowan Lee, CEO of the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association, joins me now. Hello, Rowan.
G'day, Mary.
How will it work?
Well, what retailers will have to do as of today is report a price by 2 p.m., just say this afternoon, for a price that will apply from 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. So you nominate a price by 2 p.m. today. The government will publish that price by 4 p.m. on their app, and then that cap starts at 6 a.m. the next morning. So from 6 a.m., you can't just say nominate, say $2, okay? So your price will be $2, and all you can do for the next 24-hour period is trade downwards, not upwards. So you can't go down to $1.90 and say up to $2 again. You can only keep trading down for a 24-hour period.
Right. So which app can people find this on?
It's on the Services Victoria app, but the Victorian government's taking quite an unusual approach. In every other state where this sort of system applies, there's open source data. So you can go to any of the open source apps such as Petrol Spy, Motor Mouth, there's a whole RACV even, and they release data to all of those other apps so that consumers can see quite clearly on a range of different platforms what petrol prices are. And we've got no problem with that at all. But for some reason, the Victorian government wants to keep that data on their own app for a 24-hour period at least.
So petrol retailers find this an okay way of going about it?
Well, we don't know how this is going to play out yet. I think what will happen is that the discounters, the independents, will probably price themselves a bit more conservatively than what they do now because they don't want to be caught out. So I think what they'll do is they'll probably nominate a cap, which is fairly conservative, and then they'll just trade down to meet the market throughout the course of the next 24 hours.
And this is all happening from today. Is everyone on board, do you think, Rowan Lee?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, all the retailers are on board. I know that. But we'll see what happens with motorists and how that changes their purchasing habits.
What do you expect to happen?
Well, I think if you're nominating a cap at the start of the day by 6 a.m., you know that's going to be the highest price during the course of the next 24 hours. So, you know, people might start buying towards the tail of the day on their way home from work, say, instead of on their way to work, because they know that, you know, the 6 a.m. cap will be the cap and you can only go down after that.
Rowan Lee, thank you for explaining that to us. I will be back again in this chair tomorrow. Really looking forward to it. Thank you for all your texts and calls today. Join you then.